BCFM Community Radio for Bristol on 93.2 FM. For more information or to listen live on the internet, go to our website at www.bcfm.org.uk. BCFM, your radio.
Hello and welcome to this week's Dalek Radio. The show is coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to all in Bristol, and also to everyone in Preston, and also to our audience in South America. This week we feature on the state of the local newspaper. Which one could that be? With its giant offices at the bottom of Old Market Street. Their sales are plummeting, and in particular we feature the future role of the journalist in light of the large number of NUJ, or National Union of Journalist members, made redundant this month. On this subject, we have an interview with Christina Zaba, chair of Bristol NUJ and a freelance journalist. Tony Gosling brings us a feature on coal and global warming. Malcolm Greaves continues to read another chapter of The History of the Mafia, the penultimate episode this week. Anthea Page interviews Claire Playthorne from the Africa Initiative Organisation, and Jeff Sparks, as ever, rounds up our show with the latest What's On. My name is John Peters Coleman. We'll start the show this week with an interview with Christina Zaba at the recent Opportunities Day held recently by Bristol Media and the Bristol branch of the NUJ. Afterwards, we will discuss with Tony Gosling the impact of the recent redundancies of members and the damage to the industry in general.
I'm here with Christina Zaba, I'm the NUJ, the Bristol branch. Hello.
Hi.
Can you tell us what the event today was all about?
Today was called New Opportunities for Journalists Day. Basically, what's been happening in the regional and local media across the country is that media organisations have been decimated, really blown to bits, because of the recession and also because of other structural changes in the industry. They've been cutting the regional local news offering, which is very bad for communities all across the country. And obviously in the southwest, it's particularly bad for Bristol. ITV has merged the newsroom between Plymouth and Bristol, so now you're getting one news hub for all the news from Land's End to Gloucester, which is clearly stupid. The newspapers, the Bristol Evening Post has cut a third of its staff, the Western Daily Press is down to just two reporters now. We're not going to see local and regional news as we've known it, and that's a big concern. I'm chair of Bristol branch of the National Union of Journalists, and it's my job to take care of the members. So the journalists who are losing their jobs are obviously in a terrible state. Now, I know there's a recession on and lots of people all over are losing their jobs, and I'm not asking for special pleading, but trade unions can do a lot to help. And in the National Union of Journalists Bristol branch, what we decided to do to help on a voluntary basis was to organise a day to let our colleagues and members from who are losing their jobs and all the other freelancers who are finding it so difficult to get work now, to let them know what the opportunities are in the city and in the region. Because the truth is that although the news organisations are contracting, the media, new media and new ways of working are expanding. And so today was really about opening those doors.
What about the BBC? Have they cut any jobs?
The BBC aren't in such a terrible state. They are supported by the government, you know, by the licence fee, and they're a bit more stable.
And how many journalists are we talking about, roughly? Do you have any figures?
Yeah, well, a third. So from Bristol Evening Post and the press, from 154, and that was after 20% were cut 2 years ago. So that was already a skeleton staff. We're now down to under 100.
So why do they always cut the jobs that reflect the life of the ordinary people?
Because
the big national newspapers.
I know. There are lots of good. That's a very good question, and the answers aren't easy to find, to be honest. Because these are organisations which are in profit, but because they're owned by shareholders, that's the kind of ownership model. Rather than like the BBC paying a licence, their duty is to shareholders. And although they're still very profitable, they say the profits are dropping, and so they're trying to cut staff in order to keep the profits high, which we, in the NUJ, believe is the wrong way around. You've got to start with quality journalism. That's what it's about. You know, news and journalism is a service to the community, and it's an important part of keeping democracy healthy.
So do you think if they cut jobs, then the standard will fall, then people won't buy the paper?
Yes, it's a downward spiral, sadly. The standard has fallen and will fall drastically. You cannot have two reporters covering seven counties. It's just absolutely stupid. And what they are doing is rewriting press releases and other material that comes into the office. They don't have time to do the proper journalism of investigating, going out, finding, listening, evaluating, checking and doing it for themselves and delivering a story that people can trust. But why it's happening, it's to do with ownership of the media. And I think that now the Culture Secretary in the government, Andy Burnham, is concerned, finally, and he is pulling together a commission to look at the ownership of regional and local news. Well, that's fine, and maybe it'll turn around and come around again, and maybe the bandwagon will roll. But meanwhile, today, yesterday, our members lost their jobs, and so it's a bit useless for me to say to, you know, somebody over there, well, don't worry, it'll be fine in 18 months' time. You know, they've got bills to pay now. What about next week? So that's what this day was about. It was providing a bridge, really, from those, for whatever reason, falling apart media to media that are perhaps a bit more buoyant and showing people not only that they can find other jobs, but that they can also be self-employed or indeed set up businesses of their own.
What about the photographers? Because people forget that photographers are journalists too.
Yeah.
Have they been affected by the cuts? Have they been made redundant?
Yeah, well, a lot of photographers were freelance to begin with, but they've found their markets shrinking. And obviously, if the Bristol Evening Post, Western Daily Press are not sending out reporters, they're not sending out photographers either in the same numbers. So do as we will, there's nothing we can do about it. They're just not being sent out. So, again, if you're a professional photographer, what are you going to do? There's only so many weddings. And besides, it's not about that. It's about taking photos for the news.
Do you know the figures for the readership of the Evening Post and Western Daily Press?
Well, I know that at one stage, I wouldn't like to be an authority on this, and I haven't looked it up, but I know that they're dropping and dropping and dropping. I mean, the figures used to be 50, 60,000, you know, and now I think it won't be a half that way, maybe two-thirds. It isn't a good sign. I mean, part of it, they blame online, and that's true, that a lot of people do read their news online, but we believe, and we know, in fact, for a fact, that there is still a massive need for proper local news where people will find out what's going on right here.
So at the end of today, do you think more people were encouraged to think, well, maybe I could get a job in PR if I'm a journalist, or do you think they're still a bit depressed and downheartened?
Well, it wasn't just about PR. It was also about running your own business, setting up your own journalism service as a freelance. In fact, being more investigative in a way. But we're also looking at the nuts and bolts of how the money works out, because it's all very well to say, oh, yeah, well, we'll go and do our thing. But at the end of the day, it has to be a viable business. So we were really looking at that. We had business advisors here who showed colleagues, you know, what it would actually be like to run your own business. I thought that was very helpful. As to PR, what we did have today was a presentation of this new industry, relatively new as opposed to newspapers, which is really growing, and people were able to really understand and hear from experts and practitioners what kinds of things they would need to do to get into that if they wanted to. My hope as branch chair of the Bristol National Union Journalists is that by doing all this we'll retain the skills in the region, and that when the wheel turns, as it will, we'll be able to call people back or possibly set up other models that have integrity of local news gathering.
And lastly, could you just mention the Bristol Media? Yeah, because that's an important organisation in Bristol, isn't it?
It certainly is, yeah. They've got a lot of members. Of course, they're quite lucky because they do get money from South West Regional Development Agency, largely. I know that they're working towards independence from that, but it's great to have that boost to set up. So at the moment, they've got 1,500 businesses, about 3,000 members. Membership is free and it's online. If you're in the creative industries and you want to either expand your business or join a business or get a job or advertise yourself, it's there. And they also have networking events at Goldbrick House. The website is www.bristolmedia.co.uk. And the NUJ website is www.nuj.org.uk. Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
That was Christine Azaba talking to Anthea Page at the recent Opportunities Day conference held here in Bristol. And apologies for the sound quality problems through that recording. Tony Gosling, National Union of Journalists member and freelance journalist, is here in the studio. Well, as he is most weeks, in fact. But he's in front of the microphone this time. Tony, what do you think about the issues that have been raised here?
Well, yes, we've had something like 40, which is around about between two-thirds and a third and a quarter of the journalists and sort of writers, etc., at the Evening Post made redundant over the last few weeks. So, I mean, that's a sizable slice of the journalists on the paper and in the building. But this is really part of a much wider problem in journalism at the moment. I think what we're seeing is really an unprecedented crisis in journalism. Just as an example, the journalists have their own or our own trade magazine, which I subscribe to, called the Press Gazette. Now, the Press Gazette has been going every week for the last, about 55, or maybe 45, certainly at least 45 years. And it was just announced last week, the end of last week, that was going to fold up and there's going to be no more weekly news for journalists. Now, that's despite the fact that there are something like 2,500 subscribers to the Press Gazette, each of which pays about £120 a year to subscribe, that is now considered to be not a viable publication. So that shows you what kind of situation we're in. I mean, for journalists now, the only regular magazine which is devoted to the industry is the NUJ's own in-house magazine. The redundancies that we've been seeing at the Evening Post are really as a result of, as Christina was saying, the culture of really that the paper is a kind of almost in a schizophrenic state, because as many newspapers, and the Evening Post is not the only one, it has divided loyalties. It's got loyalties to its readers, but it's also got loyalties to its shareholders. And I think what's happening, what with the financial crisis, is that the voices on the boards of these big newspapers, the owners of the printing presses and the owners of the buildings, are really saying that, I'm sorry, but you know, it's the financial priorities that have to come first, and the readers, what the readers want, second.
When there are usually a lot of people at this juncture who sort of trumpet that the digital revolution is obviously going to affect press in a sort of physical paper form. Surely, I mean, all of this can just sort of be sucked up by the internet. And
well, yeah, the thing is, though, that the content on the internet, the stories that you read on the internet, are free. Now, I mean, the industry is changing like I've never seen, you know, certainly in my lifetime, because you're getting the big media corporations like News International, that's Rupert Murdoch, who owns Sky, the News of the World, the Sun, the Times, and what Rupert Murdoch's able to do, because he's got such a big financial base, is to actually print loss leaders, right? That's to say free newspapers like you get in London, like the Metro, for example, which makes it almost impossible for a small independent newspaper to survive. And the problem there is what's going on is that we're seeing the media concentrated into fewer and fewer hands. So whereas beforehand there were laws that stopped television companies owning newspapers, newspaper and vice versa, newspaper companies owning TV stations and radio stations, now that's all out of the window pretty much. And we're seeing these sort of global mega corporations sucking up the few remaining outlets. And of course that means that there's less jobs at the end of the day, because we're seeing less overall outlets, newspapers, TV, radio. Even though there's loads of different stations on the television, you'll find actually there's, you know, globally, there's less, because so many of these corporations are now, rather than regional or national, a global corporation.
So this means more opportunities for the BBC, which doesn't have shareholders.
Well, the BBC is an interesting case, because also the union is very strong at the BBC, the NUJ is, and although it hasn't really been trumpeted around much, there's recently been a ballot of the union at the BBC, which was a 77% in favour of 2 days of industrial action. Now, that's one of the reasons why there's been no compulsory redundancies at the BBC. Because, of course, what a compulsory redundancy programme, like's happened at the Evening Post, enables the management to do is to target specific individuals and say, well, we don't like this journalist, we'll get rid of him or her. And so that hasn't happened at the BBC, and it's nice to see that certainly the NUJ members at the BBC are very much aware that if they start going down the road of compulsory redundancies, then people may be targeted for their political views, and that's the last thing we want to see to keep journalism healthy and thriving.
Focusing on the newspapers, the sort of content is split between in-house and freelance, even though the Evening Post has got rid of a lot of their in-house. Presumably that would just be taken up by more freelance.
Well, no, because this is the crazy thing. You know, I would say crazy anyway, although they would probably find that the management at the Evening Post would argue against me, but they have a very, very little freelance budget. Even if a very good story comes along written by a freelancer, if the freelancer tells the editor about it, whereas in the most normal situations, that freelancer would then be able to have the opportunity to make a little bit of money on one story, the management and the editors at the Western Daily Press and Evening Post are told no freelance budget virtually. I mean, I know at the Western Daily Press, for example, was something like 2 freelance articles accepted over the period of a month. You know, so the chances of freelancers actually taking over where the staff journalists have left off is virtually zero. And of course, it means that the newspaper tends to be more inward-looking. It's not accepting more interesting stories from around the city. And, of course, many of the journalists that work at the Evening Post and Western Daily Press simply sit at their workstations all day and don't hardly get out at all.
Right. How are you getting on as a freelance journalist?
It's very difficult surviving now as a freelance journalist, particularly in Bristol. I think if you're working in London, there's a lot more opportunities, but locally it's very difficult.
So you're finding it a struggle as a freelance journalist?
Yeah. Yeah, it's definitely, yeah. The other thing I'd say is that this Opportunities Day that the NUJ and Bristol Media ran a week or so ago, one of the things they're looking at there was getting into public relations, because this is one of the traditional sort of ways that journalists can make quite a bit of money if they come out of journalism. Okay. It's basically going from being a good journalist, a professional journalist, which means you're trying to be as unbiased as possible to show both sides of an argument, whereas in public relations you're there to basically manage the reputation of a company or an industry or whatever. So, for example, the PR people at Bristol City Council will be there doing everything they can to make sure that Bristol City Council is projected in a good light. Yeah, so that's not quite the same as being a journalist, where you're trying to get a balance between different points of view.
Okay, now knowing you as I do, I can't imagine you really being sucked into PR, particularly for Bristol City Council. But have you ever been tempted?
I have done PR work. Yeah, I did do PR work, but I think you have to try at least. There are some very good PR jobs around, actually. Like, for example, working for the National Health Service can be quite good. But you see, even those public service industry types of PR jobs have changed a lot over the years. I mean, friends of mine worked in the old days before privatisation of a lot of these things. Would say that the PR job in those days was really just simply being a mechanism by which journalists can get in touch with the real decision makers. So, for example, in the old days with the gas board and the water board, what would happen is a PR person wouldn't actually go on the TV themselves. What they'd do is they'd make sure that the general manager for that part of the country was on TV explaining why something had gone wrong.
Right.
Nowadays, those public relations people aren't doing that kind of job so much. They're much more just sort of pushing a corporate line and projecting a positive image rather than trying to sort of be unbiased.
So the whole setup, really, the effect of the recession is it's harming the ability for sort of an objective truth about what is actually going on to be put out to people.
The real problem here is we're facing a serious democratic deficit in journalism, in that the questions that should be being asked about the rich and powerful aren't being asked anymore.
Which is just why you should be listening to Free Local Radio, committed volunteers doing the hard grafts, because people at the Evening Post won't. Is there anything else that you'd like to reflect on?
Well, just one thing, and that is another avenue that quite a lot of journalists are taking, and that is self-publishing. Mm-hmm. So that means that now we have the technology to print and do desktop publishing and do a magazine from home. A lot more journalists are, rather than going into public relations or some other industry where they're employed by somebody else, are setting up their own little outfits, producing magazines and that kind of thing. So you know, going right. It's a little bit. I mean, traditionally, radio was one of the things where, as a journalist, you would be in control of the whole process. In other words, yeah. you would be doing editing pieces, etc. You'd be interviewing somebody, and you would be in control of the entire process. Traditionally, in print, it was impossible to do that. But now, with desktop publishing and that kind of software, you can simply go and be doing interviews. You can be preparing articles and desktop publishing them and just sending them off to be printed yourself.
Does not the the idea of an individual being in control of so much mean that the objective truth may possibly get harmed? There is more opportunity for bias to seep through the entire process. There's no independent editorial body.
Not really. I mean,
prove this.
Not really, no. I mean, I think it's better that there aren't people hanging around in the background telling you what you should be writing and what you shouldn't be writing. I think most journalists would say they want to write what they want to write. They'd much rather not have an editor with an agenda peering over their shoulder saying, what's this you're up to?
Okay. Thank you very much for talking to us, Tony Gosling. And I'm sure we will cover this topic in future episodes. Now for a song from Gus Band, performed at the open mic evening at the Thunderbolt Pub in Totterdown.
An MP suggested that we introduce an oath of allegiance into schools and places of work, and I don't think the idea was passed, so I wrote my own oath of allegiance, which goes like this. Oaths of allegiance are social congealments in countries like the States and Korea. If it's true we need one, we'd better get a move on, or else we won't know who we are. I swear to live on tin food all of my life. I swear to go to school armed with a knife. I swear to wear clothes that belong to my wife, 'cause that's what makes me British. I swear to wave a little Union Jack while dropping bombs on Iraq. I swear to enjoy a jolly good smack, 'cause that's what makes me British. People of the world, just sing this song, and you'll be one of us before too long. I swear to get pissed on a Saturday night. I swear to go abroad and start a fight. I swear to keep my arsehole firmly tight, 'cause that's what makes me British. I swear to surrender all of my wealth and then die on the national health. I swear to take the piss out of myself, 'cause that's what makes me British.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Our next feature is an interview with Claire Playthorne, talking to Dialect reporter Anthea Page in the foyer of the Colston Hall at Women's Independence Day about the African Initiative Organisation and the work they do in Ghana and Tanzania.
Claire Playthorne.
And can you tell us what you're doing here today?
Yeah, sure. I'm with African Initiatives, and we're representing particularly the work that we're doing with women and around women's rights in Ghana and Tanzania. In Tanzania, we work with an organisation called the Pastoral Women's Council, and they are the only women's council of that type working with Maasai women in Tanzania. And the work that they do is with women, do microcredit schemes in order to empower women, allow women to have a say in their own lives, allow them to be economically more independent so that they're not entirely dependent on the men who they live with for their resources in the household. They also work a lot with promoting girls' education. So
is this like a safety net?
It wasn't designed as a backup support in this case, but it does certainly provide that in the event of them not being able to raise sufficient funds from their livestock. But what it allows is women to control their own income on such matters in the home, on clothing, on allowing their children, paying for their children to go to school, equipment for their children to go to school, because normally they'd rely on their husband having to sell one of their animals in order to raise money for the family. And often the man didn't want to do that sort of thing because he didn't feel that it was that it was a particularly sufficient enough reason, or that it was minor trivial things to be spent on in the home or with children, equipping children to go to school and so on. So really it was just to allow women to have greater control over their lives and their family, really. So that was the inspiration for the work. What some of the women do is that they own several goats, for example. So it allows women to buy some goats. It allows them then to use the milk and so on from the goats, also sell the goats if they want to raise money for their families. So it allows women to set up small shops and so on for their local communities. So it tends to be spent in those ways.
And where does the money come from?
We provide funding basically for BC, and they're also funded by several other international organisations. We raise money for PwC from trusts, other larger organisations in this country.
Is it similar work between Tanzania and Ghana?
It's working with, again, it's slightly different, another local NGO, but it is quite different in its nature. The work is a CSRC, which stands for Community Self-Reliance Centre, and the work that they do with women is to empower women, work around female genital mutilation, women's rights.
So, does that still go on, female mutilation?
Yes, it does, but it has decreased significantly in the areas that they work in. But yes, it is still a widespread practice.
And do they have a lot of problems over there with things like drought or floods?
There are issues with climatic change, but the main issue that a lot of the farmers have suffered from in Ghana is with tomatoes. A large proportion of the farmers there produce tomatoes, but the local market has been flooded by overseas imports from the United States and from Italy, which means that these tin tomato products are sold at very low price, which undercuts the tomato farmers with their fresh tomatoes. And so many tomatoes are produced at certain times of year that the crop becomes almost worthless, and the Ghanaian tomato farmers are unable to sell their product because they're being undercut by these imports. And obviously that has a lot of effects in the local community, not only in terms of what they're able to sell their tomatoes, the price that they're able to sell the tomatoes, but also it's significantly less healthy to be eating tomatoes with sugar and salt and so on from a concentrate in a tin than it is to be using your local product that's grown in your local community. So it has other effects. And they're extremely sort of strongly marketed and advertised, these tomatoes. So it sounds incredible, but it's a practice that certainly goes on in communities where significant numbers of tomatoes are locally grown, and it just doesn't support the local community.
There's something else worrying about the tomato industry in Ghana.
Yes, another thing that's really troubling us is that one of the local processing plants for tomatoes, which allows the farmers to sell their raw product to be transformed into tin tomato product, has actually been taken over by a foreign company. An Italian tomato producer has actually bought one of the local processing plants of tomatoes, and that foreign company has kept the processing plant closed in order to promote overseas imports, basically. And so what happens is many tomatoes are produced, but many of those tomatoes then go on to rot and be inedible.
So the company that's importing the tomatoes has actually stopped the locals from processing their own tomatoes?
Yes, in effect, it does seem to point to that. So another aspect of the work of the organisations that we work with is to really promote local tomatoes and really go out and educate the people who live in these communities, and to promote the local product as being healthier, better for them, and obviously far better for their local community, because it's supporting the local economy.
Can people find out more about this?
Yes.
Do you have a website?
Certainly, yeah. People can go to our website, which is www.african-initiatives.org.uk. And on the website there's more information about all of the partners that we work with in both Ghana and Tanzania, and also the development education work that we do in the UK.
That was Claire Playthorne talking to Anthea Page. This is a song called Steam Packet from the group Strawhead, who performed recently at the church in Oust. If you're interested in early English music, the church at Oust organises a concert once a month, and you can look them up on the internet. If you put in Oust, which is A-U-S-T, and music into Google, that will bring it up. Or you can contact Peter Dobbins directly on 01454
632 306.
Oh, what a row, what a rumpus and a rioting. Those in due, you may be sure, who go to sea. A ship is a thing that you never can be quiet in. By wind or steam, 'tis all the same to saw with me. Wife and daughter on the water said they'd like to sail a bit. I consented, soon repented and began to rail a bit. Papa, no, pray do go today. The weather's so inviting, look, I'm sure 'twill do such good to you. They feed you like a fighting cock. Oh, what a row, what a rumpus and a rioting. Those in jaw, you may be sure who go to sea. A ship is a thing that you never can be quiet in. By wind or steam, 'tis all the same, 'twas so with me. In a boat, I go afloat, as clumsy as an elephant, so spruce and gay to spend the day and make a splash. Indeed, it's true, I did it too, for stepping in, I fell off onto an overboard. Upon me word, I went slapdash. Wife squalling, daughter bawling, everything provoking me. Called a hog or poodle dog, all the sailors joking me. Dripping wet, in a pet, with many more distressables. A fella took a bow, took and caught me inexpressibles. Oh, what a row, what a rumpus and a rioting. Those in jaw, you may be sure, who go to sea. A ship is a thing that you never can be quiet in. By wind or steam, 'tis all the same to so with me.
That song Steam Packet was performed by Strawhead, a group that specialises in performing early English songs. We go from steamships to coal now. It's been a boom winter for the coal industry, unexpectedly in such times of recession, and Bristol has been no exception. With people worried about gas supplies being cut off from Russia, companies selling solid fuel or mixed fuel stoves have been literally snowed under. It's meant a new lease of life for local coal merchants, such as Sean Jenkins and Lionel James from Barretts in Whitchurch. Our Dialect reporter Tony Gosling went to find out how the industry is going.
My name is Sean Jenkins. I'm the transport manager of AJ Barrett Limited, based in Whitchurch in Bristol. The company has been long established in the local area, serving individuals as well as obviously local established businesses. We're a haulage company and also a solid fuel merchant.
So what are you primarily? Have you branched out from coal into doing haulage as well?
Yes, I mean, traditionally we were always a coal merchant. Obviously, with the reduction of the coal industry generally over a period of years, in order to survive, the haulage side of the business has expanded, but we are still very much a coal merchant.
So are you actually really a local business? Because a lot of businesses that maybe seem to be local are just franchises for some other big organisation.
No, we're a completely independent business. The haulage side of our business isn't done so much on contract work. It is purely repeat business by word of mouth or by existing good business procedure, if you like. The customers we work for tend to come back to us because of the nature of the jobs that we've done in the past. As far as the coal side of the business is concerned, pretty much the same, really. We've got an established book of customers, all that are within, I would say, probably a 10-mile radius of where we actually operate from, private individuals, and we deliver to and from their houses.
Now, for many people at the moment, they are thinking carefully about their energy bills. We've seen both electricity to a lesser extent, but certainly gas bills going up astronomically, really. I mean, we're talking about 30-40% some of these bills. And how does coal actually compare, and how can people tell whether coal might be a viable option in their home?
Well, the price of coal obviously has followed suit to a certain degree over the last sort of 12 to 18 months. There's been a tremendous hike in the price of it, obviously buying it in bulk to ourselves, which is, we've had no option but to obviously pass on to the customer. If we don't, then we'll go under, you know. It's because you have to make it an economical proposition as a business. Having said that, compared to what the private individual is burning, like I said in the previous answer, really, it is completely up to their own pocket how much they actually spend on it.
And that's just the same
burning.
But that's just the same with gas, surely. I mean, you know, if you think your gas bill is going to be a bit too high, you just turn the heater down or you use it less.
Yes, it would be. But I think the difference with the core is that you can physically feel it around you, and you can see that what you're burning isn't being wasted as such. Well, I suppose it's completely within your own control, as opposed to heating water that you don't necessarily need to.
Yeah, there is. So the other thing, it's just occurred to me, of course, is the standing charge. You have a standing charge whether you're using gas or not, and the same with electricity. Anyway, a friend of yours has just come in. Now, who's this?
Yeah, this is my father. This is actually my
maybe. Fav. We'll let him introduce himself, yeah. Shall we?
No, I'm just Mr. Barrett.
So you are actually where the original name came from. Can you tell us how you've seen the coal business change over the years? You must have seen lots of changes.
We haven't heard anything from the government, and they just want to see us gone, I think, personally.
Well, of course, there's lots of very powerful interests at stake here. I mean, the energy industry generally is a very tough market. Either of you can answer. Whereabouts does the coal you sell here come from, most of it?
Go on.
Predominantly, the British market would be coal basically dug up over in South Wales. Having said that, the anthracite market. There is also a resurgence of Midlands coal coming into the marketplace now.
So these are still operating pits. You see, I think a lot of people might think that there isn't really much of a British coal industry left.
There's none. There's only a couple of pits left on a domestic market in the Midlands. All the anthracite comes from South Wales, and all the bituminous coal comes from the Midlands.
Okay, we've immediately anthracite and bituminous coal. Most people probably don't know the difference. What is the difference?
Well, anthracite is smokeless fuel, and bituminous coal is sooty coal, if you like to call it.
Because, of course, there are regulations, aren't there, about whether you can use specific types of coal, usually in the city areas. Do you want to just explain a bit about that?
Yeah, I mean, there is a regulation in force to say that, obviously, coal that produces smoke should not be burnt in a smoke-controlled area, which tends to be the inner city areas. Obviously, we are very careful about who we supply coal to, but we do operate from our yard, obviously, a cash-and-carry service as well. The area we tend to supply tends to stretch from our existing premises in Whitchurch, sort of out of the city boundary into sort of more rural areas and the surrounding villages. And those are the sort of people you might find are burning more of the bituminous coal. The anthracite coal tends to be supplied into the city areas.
So is it a big difference in price and you know, quality and ease of getting the different types of coal?
The ease of getting the coal, I mean, that really is dealt with through our own suppliers, obviously. There are a number of factoring companies that we can sort of go to say, you know, we want a particular type of coal delivered to us. In terms of the quality and the price, I mean, obviously everyone's got different sort of appliances which they're trying to burn the coal on. Some people use it to cook on it. Some people use it to just heat their houses. Depending upon the type of appliance, you'll have either a bituminous or a smokeless. Some fuels will cross over to a certain degree on certain appliances. But in terms of the price, I mean, there's been a tremendous difference on the bituminous coal, certainly, in the last 12 months. I mean, it's gone, you know, the price of it's really sort of increased dramatically. Yeah, it's caught up with the anthracite price. You know, historically, I would say, you know, the price of fuel is going to increase from year to year, but it's just the percentage increase has just gone absolutely wild.
So, I mean, I always remember hearing that South Wales coal was some of the best coal in the country. So can you tell us if that's true? Is that just a rumour?
No, not anymore. You know, we've had 15 years of imported anthracite, and it's been the best since sliced bread, as we call it. But now we're solely dependent now on South Wales anthracite, and it's to us, it's quality is not quite as good as some of the imported anthracite.
The trouble is, though, of course, you know, shipping coal halfway across the world is not really the way that hopefully is going to be happening in the future. We want local coal to be burnt locally rather than, you know, literally shipping it halfway around the world, don't we?
Until 12 months ago, the imported coal was an awful lot cheaper than our Welsh anthracite. And it's the money markets which got us into this trouble now, I think.
Well, I suppose it's because a lot of the shipping companies are finding life difficult, so they're putting the price up. And that, in a way, isn't that a good thing, that now that there's a more realistic price of imported coal?
Yeah, but there's not enough coal in this country to supply our needs. We're solely dependent on just one or two quarries in South Wales.
That was Sean Jenkins and Lionel James from Barrett's Coal Merchants in Whitchurch. They're talking to Dialect's Tony Gosling.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
Before Malcolm continues with the penultimate instalment of the history of the Mafia, this week about Frank Sinatra, we'll hear a few notes from just that very man himself. I did it my way.
And now the end is near, and so I face the final curtain, my friend. I'll say it clear, I'll state my case, of which I'm certain. I've lived a life that's full, I traveled each and every highway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Regrets I've had a few, but then again too few to mention. I did what I had to do, saw it through without exemption. I planned each charted course, each careful step along the byway, and more, much more than this, I did it my way. Yes, there were times, I'm sure you knew, when I bit off more than I could chew. But through it all, when there was doubt, I ate it up and spit it out. I faced it all and I stood tall and did it my. I've had my fill, my share of losing, and now as tears subside, I find it all so amusing to think I did all that, and may I say, not in a shy way. Oh no, oh no, not me. I did it my way. For what is a man? What has he got? If not himself, then he has not.
That was Frank Sinatra himself singing I Did It My Way. It's time now for another instalment of The History of the Mafia, read by Malcolm Greaves.
The History of Organised Crime by David Southwell. There's a traditional Sicilian saying, a word in the right ear can make or murder a man. Organised criminals have always attempted to link themselves with the rich, famous and powerful. Having friends in high places is one of the best ways to stay out of jail and to boost your criminal network. In most cases, it is obvious what both sides get out of the friendship. A senior judge who spends time with mob bosses is unlikely to be discussing a mutual interest in legal reform. The majority of relationships between the judiciary, police and gangsters are purely financial. It is usually a matter of straightforward bribery and corruption. Justice perverted by crime's financial muscle and the greed of man. When it comes to criminal links to politicians, the stake is often power. Organised criminals can use their power of intimidation to deliver votes. In return, they often expect the official they helped elect to use his position to deliver them anything from tax breaks to immunity to government contracts. It is often harder to fathom the nature of the relationship between high echelon espionage agents and assorted illicit groups. Both sides tend to be expert at keeping secrets. The same can be said of the contact between high-ranking churchmen and the mafia, where the reasons for either side cultivating powerful allies in the other camp are often shrouded in mystery. Perhaps the most authentic friendships between the underworld and the rich and famous are those forged with certain celebrities. Gangsters can hunger after glamour as much as anyone, and even the bright lights of show business as shadows, where well-built, well-armed friends do not go amiss. At least here, when two worlds meet, there is often genuine respect and fondness. Alongside the money, of course. Frank Sinatra was not a member of the Mafia, although you could be forgiven for thinking he was. The publicity his links to Cosa Nostra received was enough to make his fans suspicious. J. Edgar Hoover was so convinced Sinatra was part of the mob that he authorised hundreds of hours of investigation into the star's life. Although no charges were ever brought against him, Sinatra's 2,403-page FBI report almost saw Old Blue Eyes prosecuted for extortion. A reading of the file makes it clear that Sinatra had the right connections to become a made man and could have had his pick of joining several mafia families. However, if Frank had joined, it would have been purely honorary. He was an entertainer, not a killer. Alongside his associations with top Cosa Nostra leaders, Sinatra also had the required Italian-American pedigree for membership and an established family link. Sinatra's uncle, Babe Gavaranti, had been an associate of New Jersey crime boss Willie Moretti before Babe had been convicted of murder in 1921. Strangely enough, it was Willie Moretti who became the star's first major mafiosi friend. Moretti had spotted the young Sinatra singing in his New Jersey clubs in the 1930s and always gave him work. The former hitman and the struggling singer forged a bond of genuine friendship, and Frank ran into his first major professional problem. He asked Moretti to help him out. Frank had signed a contract with bandleader Tommy Dorsey, but Dorsey refused to let Sinatra go as the singer's career began to rocket. In 1943, after he had offered Dorsey more than $60,000 to rip up the contract, Frank's friend Willie began negotiating. This involved Moretti jamming the barrel of a gun in Dorsey's mouth to encourage him to sign away his interests in Sinatra for a mere $1. This incident became a well-known show business tale, and Mario Puzo included it in his best-selling novel The Godfather, where Sinatra became singer Johnny Fontaine. When Sinatra saw Puzo in a restaurant, he verbally attacked the author, made serious threats, and used words he certainly never featured in any of his records. Frank had a habit of threatening people who wrote things he didn't like about the Mafia. In 1960, again in a restaurant, he attacked Desi Arnaz, whose production company with his wife Lucille Ball had made the hit TV show The Untouchables. If old Blue Eyes was so concerned about the publicity his Mafia links attracted, he should have reconsidered acts such as flying to Havana in 1946 to sing for his friend Charles Lucky Luciano at a commission meeting and giving him a gold lighter inscribed, "To my dear pal Charlie," from his friend Frank. It may also have been wiser not to give Chicago syndicate boss Sam Giancana a sapphire friendship ring, and he should have known better than to be photographed in the company of gangsters such as Carlo Gambino. When the Cefalva investigations into mob activities questioned Sinatra in 1950, he admitted to knowing Luciano, Moretti, Joe Adonis, Bugsy Siegel, Frank Costello, and Mayor Lansky. When Lansky was building up Las Vegas and needed to pull in the punters, he gave Sinatra a 9% stake in the Sands Hotel in return for the Rat Pack performing there. Sinatra and his crew gave Las Vegas a big boost, and the Mafia looked after Frank and his pals well while they were in the desert. When comedian Jackie Mason was in Vegas in 1966 and made a couple of anti-Frank jokes in his nightclub routine, his hotel room was shot up, and he suddenly found he could no longer get work in the town. Amongst Sinatra's Rat Pack pals was Peter Lawford, the actor and husband of John F. Kennedy's sister Patricia. This gave Sinatra access to the Kennedy family that Sam Giancana tried to exploit. At one point, through Sinatra introducing them both to the same woman, Judy Campbell, JFK and Giancana even became points in a bizarre love triangle. However, anti-mafia campaigner Robert F. Kennedy eventually banned Sinatra from seeing any of the Kennedy family. Cosa Nostra loved Frank, and he loved them right back. They had always been there for him during the highs and lows of his career. The mafiosi who called him a friend were proud of the talented Italian-American who had made good, and they loved the opportunity to rub shoulders with one of show business's legendary names.
That was Malcolm Greaves reading an instalment from The History of the Mafia, and this being the penultimate episode, eagle-eared listeners will have spotted then that the final instalment is next week. What is coming after that? Malcolm will be reading The Innkeeper's Diary, chosen for dialect by our What's On Guy dude, Jeff Sparks.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
For a man who was John Williams' muse when he wrote the Imperial March for Star Wars, Jeff Sparks, ready and waiting to deliver the very latest in What's On in Bristol.
Thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, April 24th, and at Mr. Wolf's in Bristol, Willie and the Bandits will be performing with support from Cable Sound and also Call the Doctor. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. Moving on to Saturday, 25th of April, and at Area 81 in Lawrence Hill, Bristol, Fury UK will be performing with support from Blind Ambition and Decadence. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £3 before 10 p.m. and £5 after 10 p.m. On to Song of the Week and our feature Hailstorm. This band hail from Perth in Scotland and describe themselves as true Scottish pirate metal. This track is titled Death Before the Mast and is from the album Captain Morgan's Revenge.
Fire. Feel the anger raging on my body.
That was Ale Storm with the track Death Before the Mast from the album Captain Morgan's Revenge. They will be on a UK tour from 24th of April to 3rd of May, so for further information check out myspace.com/AleStorm. Keeping with Saturday 25th of April and at the Cheese and Grain in Frome, Wishbone Ash will be performing with support from the Worried Men. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £14.50 in advance and £16.50 on the door. Moving on to Sunday 26th of April and at the Louisiana in Bristol, Artisan Quarter, Marshall C and Widespoon will all be performing. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £4 in advance. Finally, on Thursday 30th of April at the South Bank Club in Dean Lane, Bristol, there will be a blues night featuring Chris Scott's Blues Devil and support from Abel Mabel. Doors open at 9 p.m. and entry is £3 on the door. That is all from me. Thanks for listening. Have a great, good week. Take care and goodbye.
Lots of GERT stuff going on in Bristol this week. Thank you, Jeff. That's the end of this week's Dialect Radio show from the Bristol Radio Co-op, based here in the city centre, just by Queen Square. Anthony Page interviewed Christina Zaba, chair of the Bristol branch of the NUJ, and Tony Gosling, also NUJ member, was in the studio to discuss the future of journalists and local newspapers. Claire Playthorne from the African Initiative organisation was interviewed by Anthea Page. And thank you to Malcolm Grieve, who read excellently as usual another instalment of the History of the Mafia. What's On was presented by Jeff Sparks, and reporters this week were Tony Gosling and Anthea Page. Phyllis Church-Curran was the studio engineer. This week's show is produced by Anthea Page. You can download the show on the internet at www.dialectradio.co.uk. And thank you to everyone at BCFM, as always, for their sterling work. Look up BCFM on the internet. You can email us on Bristol Radio Co-op, that's all one word, at hotmail.co.uk. Goodbye from all of us here, and get in touch if you want to. We're always willing to have people along just to sit in and listen to what we do. And if you want to join in, you can do. Take care. Bye.